Charlie, do you have any questions on this movement?
I do. I'll speak loudly if you want to do this. I think I've really only got one question, but it's a bit broader. And it's really in your evidence quite clear. I mean, you say these areas have effectively a high ability to absorb the change, and Dr. Reed almost says the opposite. So can you tell me why do you disagree with each other? I'm presuming you're dealing with the same landscape. What is it? You're applying a different set of criteria, or what? Why do you say it's got a high ability to absorb? And I'm not saying I disagree with you.
Yeah.
It's just that we've got expert evidence from a number of bottom landscape architects, and they're almost at extreme ends.
So I'll separate it between SIFO and triple cone, because they're separate densities, obviously. So I guess the thing that I did take into account for both of them is the existing development, which in for both instances includes either a trek or an access road. So those slopes, and I'm talking specifically about the area where we identified the overlays as well. And so you've got the existing access road in that area, and in terms of the earthworks that have already occurred, I think quite often the access roads are actually the most visible part, and that applies for both of those areas. In terms of the base station, which was the facilities overlay at the bottom. So for Treble Cone, as part of the resource consent hearing, initially the base station was actually on the other side of the road, and there was a strong feeling that that change could not be absorbed in that location because Cattle Flat is quite an open landscape, and Dr. Reed expresses concerns about the openness of that landscape that could be compromised through the ski area extension in there, and I said in my evidence that I share that across the open flats, but the facilities overlay is actually located where the slope and the flats meet, so it's in that area where the landform changes, and that's in my view an area where change can be absorbed particularly well, because you get the view from the flats against the backdrop. And in that area, as the landform changes, you don't lose that openness that you would otherwise on the flats. But equally, you don't require the amount of earthworks that you would on the slope, and the slope's generally more visible from longer distances. So that's my response in respect of Treble Cone. So what was important for that was for the lift corridor that is directly above the access road, existing access road, and the facility is in that change of landform away from the open flats. For SOHO, the base station or the facilities overlay is in an area of the plateau that is elevated above the Cadrona road, the main Crown Range road, and it's not visible from almost anywhere. So the area where you can see this from above on the other side of the valley, which is the Snow Farm Access Road, is as you go up and you've got that elevated position. And I think it's shown quite well in my graphic attachment. If you want, you can refer to that. But otherwise, from the Crown Range Road, there are no views to that area because it is elevated above. And it's quite flat, so you won't need extensive earthworks in that area either. And I think what's important with the base station is it's not just the base station, but also the car parking, and the two kind of need to be seen together. So you need an area that's reasonably large, and in my view, as flat as possible, so you can absorb all the car parking area together with the base station.
So just in terms of that, so in terms of, I'm not a landscape architect, but in terms of the criteria or approach that landscape architects should take, using the WESI or whatever the latest, but, around sort of degrees of naturalness and responsiveness and all of those things, you apply those criteria and then say, therefore this area can absorb the change, because Dr. Reed's clearly gone through the same process and has come up with a different answer. So does she just fundamentally just agree with her, because you're saying that she hasn't really taken into account the extent of the existing environment, the extent of modification that you had to say that some form of development can get absorbed into these landscapes? Is it that simple?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you about my methodology. I'm not exactly sure what methodology she has applied.
I suppose that's the issue. I mean, I suppose, again, are you applying the same methodology?
Yeah.
Because, well, if you are, then you potentially just come to a different view. Or are we not talking apples and apples?
You want me to tell you about my methodology?
Well, you can.
VC criteria are relevant in that respect because it's an ONL. So yes, as part of the analysis of the landscape sensitivity, yes, this is something that I do apply to assess that. So it's the value in a sensitivity sense on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's the visibility of that area. And I think the two are both equally important in terms of absorbing the change. And then you also take into account, you know, what are the existing modifications, and that kind of goes into the value part, because, you know, under the ONL assessment, you also assess things like natural science and legibility, which are to some extent compromised if you already have substantial modifications like a ski field access road, which, you know, do compromise the visual coherence of a slope or the kind of high country feel that you get from that area. So that's why, so on the one hand, I assess the sensitivity and how much has that been compromised to existing modifications. On the other hand, I assess the visibility, and you know, I outlined that quite clearly in my evidence for both of those areas, as I've just summarized. And because of that, I arrived at the conclusion that the ability of the landscape to absorb the change is relatively high. Dr. Reed hasn't stated her methodology, so I can't speak for that. In my view, she has overstated the remoteness of the Upper Cagrona Valley. It does have a major road through it. Yes, it doesn't contain a lot of man-made structures in the form of buildings, but there are bridges, and it's not like it's a national park or anything. So in my view, she... And maybe that's where the difference lies, but also I think just gaining a glimpse of a view, which is a very small component of a landscape from a distant viewpoint, does not change the landscape within your distant viewpoint, and I think that's overstated. And so I try to keep that quite separate, the sensitivity of the landscape, the visibility of that area where potential proposal could take place, and that leads to my analysis.
The final question I have is around experiential, and you know, the two areas that you are giving evidence on are areas which skiing is a significant activity and other outdoor recreational activity. In landscape perspective, how much of that you take into account is these, if you are going to see a gondola or some other form of development within an ONL, this is where you'd expect to see it, so it's seen as more acceptable?
Well, I think I stated that quite clearly, that I think it's not an unexpected development for somebody who goes there and knows it's a ski field, and there are signs everywhere stating, even people who don't know that there's a ski field, by the time they get there, they will know there's a ski field because of signage and so on. I think it's not an unexpected element. You know, being from Austria, it's kind of, this is part of the ski field. You know, it forms part of an access to a ski area, and I think even people who are not coming specifically for the ski activity, they would not consider that to be something that's unconnected.
Thank you very much. Sort of following on from that, in landscape terms, mm-hmm. if you had to choose between the road access and the on-road access, which would have the lesser landscape effects?
I think it depends on the type of slope to some extent, you know, and the type of earthworks.
Yeah.
Quite often, a road actually has visually more extensive effects. If you can place towers without constructing a road by helicopter, and I know that that's possible, you know, you have to excavate the foundations and you can actually place it, but the earthworks are very, very minimal, and the towers, if they are not in a highly reflective material, that's not very visible. I mean, they're quite slender structures, and from a distance, and I, you know, looked at Cadrona again the other day, even if you know where the lifts are, you really have to look for them, whereas the Skifield Road is actually quite visible from a distance. I think what attracts your eye to a lift is more the movement of it. But the gondolas, the cabins, again, are very small. So I think from a short distance, that movement, that's something that, you know, you look at. But otherwise, from most viewpoints, at a range of distances, the Skifield Road is generally more visible. So there it really comes down on how the earthworks are being conducted. And, you know, quite often the better slopes is actually the most visible part. And if you can treat the better slopes, you know, that's the best outcome.
Mm. Now, the other question I had was in respect of that basin in Soho where the intention is. When you, in your summary in paragraph 11, you say that ski-related activity within this basin is now likely to cause higher visual effects. When you come to that conclusion, have you allowed for lifts in that basin?
Yes, I have. And I looked specifically again at that basin, you know, very recently, and it's very contained by ridge lines and it's set back. And really, the areas where you look into that basin are very confined along the Cadrona Access Road, not the Crown Range Road, the Cadrona Road. And it's mainly where you would have turned off to go up the new track. It's within that visual catchment of that basin, which is around Cadrona River Bridge 10 to 11. And so that's in a range of maybe 400 metres that you would gain a direct view into that basin. Otherwise, because of the angles of the road, it is so contained by the surrounding ridge lines that I think even with a lift, the effects would not be high.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, well, the last witness is Mr. Ferguson. And he's not prepared a separate summary, we're just going to rely on a supplementary statement.
Just a supplementary.
Yeah, just a supplementary, yes.
2 minutes for times of that, I need it. Yes, we'll need to carry. Mr. Ferguson speaks even quieter.
He does. We were talking about that before.
It's not necessarily a bad thing, it's speaking quietly, I'm sure.
Unless we're all aware of the problem.
Do you confirm your full name is Christopher Bruce Ferguson? And you've prepared a statement of evidence in chief dated 28 March and a supplementary statement dated 5 May for the purpose of this hearing?
Yes, sir.
Do you confirm that when you make statements of fact, those statements are truly correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I agree.
Will you express your opinion? You hold that based on your experience and expertise as set out in your evidence in chief?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
I thought I'd write about the penalty there.
I was going to say it might be helpful if you could read out the sum for supplementary and forward such pages, but if you start as you can probably start as I wrote four. That's where the focus is going to be,
yes.
I suspect, so it's probably easier than you trying to summarise it on the word.
Yes, well, I had been through this with a highlighter, so I can, but if you prefer, I can go through everything through what you predict will be
happening. But I'm particularly
excited. Oh, I've got my son.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I thought I was happy for you to just finish the highlighted points.
Yeah. Okay, great. I appreciate that. The paragraph 4, I just highlight in the second sentence that the main objective of the Triple Crown Soho, with respect to the mapping of the ski area subzones, has been to secure through an appropriate rule framework the provision of land-based vehicle access and or passenger lift access to both ski areas. In paragraph 5, second sentence, the alternative approach, which has been presented in this statement of supplementary evidence, presents a package of relief involving minimal changes to the extent of the ski area subzone maps, and further changes to the rural zone and the ski area subzone rules that better enable the provision of vehicle access and passenger lift access to both ski areas from outside of the ski area subzone. And I just briefly refer to Appendix 1, which is the plan, which is outlining the extent of the revised ski area subzone map in respect of the Soho ski area, which is part of the Katrona ski area subzone. And of course, in Appendix 2 is the changes of provisions, which, and I think I appreciate that as we work through them, I'm quite happy to stop, pause, go to Appendix 2 and work through as that would assist the Commission. So I described in paragraph 7 just the extent of the Cadrona ski area subzone, which reaches into the upper parts of the Callaghan's Creek and the Lincoln's Creek Basin, which has been described further in some detail in this work. And in respect of Triple Cone, of course, the revised proposal is to retain the notified ski area subzone without any changes. I talk in paragraph 9 about, just by way of background, the approach outlined within my initial statement, evidence in chief, dated 28th of March, which sets out the rationale for the extension of the ski area subzones principally to enable the development of lift access and vehicle access from respective public roads, and to a lesser degree, the summer-based recreation activities. And that approach relies on the extension to the boundaries of the ski area subzone along with the amendments to the ski area subzone rules, to provide an appropriate framework to manage effects on landscapes. In terms of the rules, the comprehensive package included measures to ensure that the potential effects of extending the ski area subzone were managed and balanced out by way of example of implementing a cut-off of 1,100 metres above sea level, below which ski area subzone visitor accommodation rules do not apply, and balancing out the effects development over a broader area with more rigorous requirements and landscape benefits. In the event the panel finds that the approach outlined in this supplementary evidence to the management of access to the ski area subzones is the most appropriate method to achieve the objectives of the plan relating to the growth, development and consolidation of the Triple Cone and Soho ski areas, the revised relief contained within Appendix 2 sets out the basis under which this could be achieved with a smaller change to the boundary of the Cadrona ski area subzone. And I expand on these below. Paragraph 11, I've just included a summary, which is for the benefit of those members of the panel may not have sat in earlier hearings, around the provisions which I've included within Appendix 2. I've set out within Appendix 2 the related provisions that sort of work together with the definitions, the different policies and the rules. Now, those include the principal objective, which is 21.2.6, and the existing policies relate specifically to the ski areas. Now, that's part of the rural zone. I've got rules from the subdivision chapter that would apply within the rural areas and the ski area subzone as proposed by Soho and Triple Cone. The rules relating to indigenous vegetation and biodiversity as amended through the evidence to the hearing on Stream 2. And some of the key definitions which might be useful for interpretation purposes around building, ski area activity and passenger lift systems. So with that, that paragraph 12, the challenges, so we've got this rule 21.4.19, which relates to ski area activities not located within the ski area subsite. The challenges to this rule build on the approach proposed in the council's writing applied to the hearing on Street 30, which is the rural chapter, to include an exemption to this rule for the development of passenger lift systems as a restricted discretionary activity. And I acknowledge here that I think there's some limitations in that approach, which is to enable the development of a passenger lift system through an exemption to a rule that restricts ski area activities outside of ski area subsite. So it, you might have gone into a double negative. And this is not an ideal basis for the construction of a rule, but I accept it's capable of being understood and sets out an appropriate framework for the assessment of the likely range of effects relating to those structures. So I consider it, and as I've outlined in detail within my evidence to the panel at Stream 2, I considered it important that the rule recognise and provide for other forms of transportation systems, including land-based vehicle access, to be considered within the scope of the restricted discretionary framework. And I just note below that the other rules which would also be triggered should that rule come into play, which is obviously the earthworks rules, which we currently have under the operative plan, but which now I understand council may be looking to include within the next stages of the review. And then we've also got the clearance of indigenous vegetation under Chapter 33 of the proposed plan, which would be a discretionary activity unrestricted. So my revised rule 21.4.19 incorporates a number of changes to the matters of discretion to provide for appropriate consideration of the effects of vehicle access. Now, I wonder if we can just turn to Appendix 2 and we can just go through those. So I've highlighted in blue the changes that would come about from the Council's reply version. So I've added in a matter of discretion around landscape values, around the alignment and surface treatment of the vehicle access particularly. The fourth little point I've just added around the addition of vehicle access to the geotechnical considerations and likewise around ecological values. And then we've got this concept of the operational requirements and the economic viability question, which was discussed earlier. And I've just slightly tweaked the positive effects. What we're talking about is the linking of the ski area subzone, the ski area activities to the district's transportation network rather than the district settlement. So I don't think we're sort of suggesting that it has to link to a settlement, we're just sort of saying that it needs to link to a transportation network. So I've just slightly tweaked that one. So that's the overall aim of that, is to provide a framework to consider both the access, land-based vehicle access, as well as passenger lift systems within that framework of a restricted discretionary activity. But the second part of that change is obviously also to lower the status from not applying down to discretionary. Good point of directing the summary. So that's what I mentioned in paragraph 15, so lowering the status of non-compliance from non-compliant activity to discretionary activity. And I note just at this point that the evidence that Mr. Macrossi has talked about, the level of investment in the facilities associated with the passenger lift system. And it's probably important in terms of the definitions to also think about the passenger lift system. The definition of passenger lift system excludes top and bottom stations. So my understanding is that it will likely be that if you're going to build a passenger lift system or a gondola access to a ski area, that is highly likely to include a ski area that's not part of the passenger lift system, but which will trigger consent at the ski area activity because of the ancillary components. So those ancillary components would include the bottom station itself, the storage and gondola buildings, or any of the other ticketing facilities that Mr. Macrossi talked about. So that would be somewhat counterproductive to providing a framework for enabling it as a restricted discretionary activity for the passenger lift system, and then all those other bits become non-compliant. Now, And coming to that view, I think I'd sort of, in that final paragraph, final sentence in paragraph 15, you know, consider that the discretionary activity status is appropriate to manage the likely effects of these activities, associated activities, and I do not see the need or the policy support for an approach that actively discourages or prevents the occurrence through non-compliant activity status. And I note within the rural zone rules of the PDP, the council's right of reply recommends that the construction of any buildings outside a building platform is a discretionary activity, and commercial activities ancillary to being located on the same site as a commercial recreation or recreation activity are also listed as a discretionary activity. So in my view, discretionary activity status will provide the appropriate balance between managing the effects of such activities and facilitation of access to the ski area subzones that would not be otherwise possible without an extension to the subzone boundaries. I'd like to skip into paragraph 17, where I just talked about the rules relating to structures and buildings, and I've just picked up in support of the amendment that was made by Ms. Vance in her section 42 report, and it was just around the exemption on building height to building out to buildings relating to towers and pylons or passage lift systems, which I agree with in principle, but I've just sort of taken it a step further to say that within that table 3 you've got a set of provisions that relate to structures and buildings generally, and one other option to address that is just to put that into the heading where you've got an existing exemption related to farm buildings and you can add it into there so that it didn't trigger any other standard relating to whether we capture towers and pylons. And just for completeness, and based on the definition of passenger lift system, I'll just, and through a discussion which I've had with Ms. Banks, I've seen the opportunity to also talk about the, you know, those attached mechanical systems that might be on top of the tower, which would need to be included within the exemption as well. So that brings us to visitor accommodation. Paragraph 19 just traverses the background under the evidence in chief, and then I guess paragraph 20 takes us to the revised proposal.
Hate to interrupt you, Mr. Ferguson, but I read this and I was rather confused because, as I understood, having sat on the rural panel,
yes,
the discussion of visitor accommodation, we were discussing in the use of the ecological management plan process was because the visitor accommodation we were talking about was above 1,070 metres where all vegetation was required consent, and a management plan obviously is part of that consent, and I understood that this, what the evidence we were hearing was that you could integrate that with the visitor accommodation. I don't recall any evidence suggesting that we were talking about something at 400 metres or 500 metres outside of the existing ski area subzones at that time.
I do recall some discussion around the what effect evidence from other parties about the perhaps the unintended consequence of having visitor accommodation provided for within the ski area subzone combined with the extension of the ski area subzone and the potential for that to result in visitor accommodation which extends all the way down to the valley floor from the top of the ski area. And as part of that, in response to that, there was three parts of the visitor accommodation rule, as I recall it, but one of those was the introduction of a standard, and that was the 1,100 metres above sea level. So what we were saying as part of that is that in the event that you've got this provided for visitor accommodation as a restricted discretionary activity, and thinking ahead to this hearing about the extension to the zone, there would need to be an obvious need to have a standard that limited your visitor accommodation activity to essentially be that on mountain, and that's where through the evidence of some crossing that the 1100 metre standard was conceived. And so that would make tension that the visitor accommodation was on the mountain.
Yes.
Now the concept of the ecological management plan was something that was proposed as I guess additional, it wasn't seen as a mitigation, but as a positive contribution to acknowledging that it was an aid of research and activity and taking that next step to provide for means of positively contributing back to the environment if that was enabled. And yes, you're right, in terms of Soho, that the predominance of vegetation, was my understanding through the evidence of Ms. Fleeger, is predominantly indigenous above about 1100, below which the patterns change and predominantly become exotic below that. But there are other areas of indigenous vegetation as well in the game, so. Yes, does that sufficiently explain the question?
Yes.
And there was a further actually EMP requirement, and it was quite unrelated, but it was for, you recall we had a discussion at the same hearing on the exemptions for indigenous to vegetation clearance rules, and
we do have a DOC approval.
Yeah, well, you have DOC approval, okay. Yes. And approved by the consent under the Conservation Act.
Yes.
And it was a really useful exchange between Ms. Galloway herself about the purpose and the intent of that legislation and how that could achieve or effectively stand in place of the RMA to make a similar standard of decision, which, as I understood it, in respect of Soho, either being land that was held under the Land Act as high contribution lease, the same obligations wouldn't apply, and the panel would not be necessarily as confident that you would be achieving the same standard for protection or maintenance of conservation values as you would under the Conservation Act. And so, in response to that, we looked at the introduction of a rule to exempt indigenous vegetation clearance within the land that's not managed under the Conservation Act, where there was an environmental management plan prepared and produced, which could relate to any part of the scheme you are talking about, which may not be related at all to visitor accommodation. But it was just a tool to say, well, look, if you want to gain an exemption for that discretionary activity status for indigenous vegetation clearance, then come up with an ecological management plan that actually sets out how you're going to manage those values.
Right, I understand all that. I agree with that. I'm just unsure how you can suggest that is now unnecessary because Soho have retracted part of their submission in relation to lower slopes.
So then
that should affect the conclusions that the earlier panel may have come to in respect of that earlier evidence. Because that seems to be what you're saying is in paragraph 21 that North Brakewood goes without the requirement of the NP. So you're suggesting that's no longer required, but I can't see how your change of position on those lower slopes could affect the conclusions that the earlier panel may have come to.
Well, just to be clear, the NP requirements would still exist if it was related to the indigenous vegetation clearance rule. So this is just in respect to visitor accommodation.
Mm.
So the concern with visitor accommodation and part of the reason for the NP originally was because of the combined introduction of the rule for visitor accommodation with the extension of the scheduled subzone. So that was part of the reason for why I recall that having that. So with the elimination of the extension to the zone and through the requirements for the EMP that could exist if you were doing indigenous vegetation clearance, I was satisfied under the revised relief without the zone that would be adequately provided for. And I also think, it probably reflects that part of the original thinking behind the EMP was to actually make a positive contribution, not as a necessary mitigation measure, but as a positive offset, if you like, for the neighbourhood and the territory. So it wasn't necessary, in my view, to have an MP in order to address the adverse, potential adverse effects that might result from visitor accommodation activities, because I thought that they were well catered for in terms of the existing problems. And I endorsed that view of my client, positively endorsed that. I thought it was a great approach. So that's one of the key differences that would be, if you like, the choices made between going with the structure of the approach as outlined in the evidence chief versus the proposed approach.
We'll have to review that. Spring to evidence.
Of course. Well, that can probably take us into subdivision, which I just want to mention that paragraph 22 would be now governed by the rural zone framework, where, so below the ski area subzone is now subject to the rural zone framework, and within the ski area subzone, and following the changes in the Crystal Bay recommendation, removing the suggested requirement for the formulation of the RMP, the revised proposal would be required to retain the request of Rule 2757, but not the suggested amendments to 2771, which is the rule related to subdivision undertaken in accordance with the structure plan, etc., etc. There's a lot to go through. I'll address that. So, in summary, my primary statement of evidence for this hearing, dated 28th of March, sets out an integrated approach to the provision of vehicle access, passages of access, and the provision of outdoor recreation by expanding the boundary of the ski area subzone. Based on the points made in the council's rebuttal evidence, Soho and Triple Cone can now support the position promoted by the council as an alternative option to the extension of minor amendments. The common thread and the key driver for both is to enable the development of lifted vehicle access to the ski areas. Soho and Triple Cone are not seeking to replace the roof sort within my area of evidence, but to present an alternative option which is more closely aligned with council, which it accepts could suit its needs. From a planning perspective, I believe the option based largely on support of the council's position is capable of implementing the relevant objectives and policies of my proposed plan.
Thank you. I've got a few, and they're pretty detailed ones. So if we go to your supplementary, what you, in the blue highlighted bits, just to confirm from there, I just want to make sure I'm right. So all these underlining strikeouts, etc., that's the base version of the council's reply version. I mean, it's not the complete set, but is it? Is that what that is? And then the blue ones are the additional changes that you're seeking as part of this hearing.
Right, okay,
thank you. So can we then go to 21.4.19, and it's the one that you were talking about in some detail, ski activities not located within a ski area subzone. You're saying it should be a discretionary activity?
Yes.
And then are A and B, because there's got an RD next to the B, but are you saying that A and B are RD? Is that how that works? So the two exceptions, they become RDs. So heli skiing and the passenger lift system, any exceptions?
Yeah, I must have known I haven't turned my way closer to the commercial heli skiing.
Oh, right.
Wasn't part of the relief package that we were.
No, okay. So,
concentrated on.
So it's RD for passenger lift. I was just trying to read off the rule and context. Okay, so RD. So then if we go to the bit we raised, that matter of discretion, operational requirements, and economic viability of the ski area, could you give me an example or tell me how that would actually work? First of all, I'm not sure what you mean by operational requirements, and I'm not even sure that starts in grabs, but and the economic viability of the ski area activities. You're not talking about the zone, you're talking about the activity. So presumably the activity is the passenger lift system. So how would a planner or a person assessing it take into account the economic viability of the passenger lift system of itself? It seems to me it takes you nowhere.
Yeah, and I think I recognise that, you know, perhaps that might need some tweaking in terms of wording, but I think what we're envisaging by including that would be that you're looking at the means of transportation to the ski area and subside as being factored in its viability or the sustainability of that operation. And I'll go back to you. Yeah. We've got a situation with Soho ski area where it's separate from the Katrina ski field. It doesn't have its own established access, and it's a reasonably large area of ski area subzone. And a key part of my evidence in terms of the strategic directions hearing was that I think there needed to be I think there needs to be a need and policy to recognise that if you have a ski area subzone which sits on an island amongst an area that's surrounded by rural, there's got to be some realisation of how that you get to that. Now that's especially important for Soho where it doesn't have an established access. So in my opinion there needs to be, you know, a policy recognition of that functional dependency of the operation of a ski area does need to be accessed, otherwise that would undermine the intention of the objective being to allow for the growth and the development and the consolidation of that ski area. So the very provision of a passenger lift system or a vehicle access is part of realising that policy of enabling that functional, resolving the tension with that functional dependency. And so that goes to the heart of, I suppose, of the viability of that ski field generally, is having some means of getting there, and that's quite important. And so that reflects that. I perhaps accept that might need to be
I think what I'm trying to do is understand the concept of the game. So you don't think the fact that a passenger lift system, which in terms of definition is to a subzone,
it's
not the anywhere, it's to a subzone, and its status is something different, RD as opposed to B, and there's a policy, that's sort of recognition enough that clearly this is something which is likely to be appropriate or good, and therefore proving, looking at the operational requirements of the benefit to the subzone is almost stated, it's almost part of the fact of the activity being restricted discretion, or is that going too far?
I think that I don't have any problem with having a signpost in the matters of discretion that go to the policy directly. So I think that's good practice to have some consistency. And I accept that the policy that I'm talking about is more about that functional dependency on the access, so it doesn't talk about economic viability. But I think that in conceptual terms, I think it was, in my mind, it was more about, you know, realising the potential of the zone through getting access to it. So that functional dependency was the important part about that matter of discretion.
So if the panel were minded to agree with it, is it more in the idea of facilitating or enabling the zone, the subzone, the purpose of the subzone, as opposed to the activity itself? Yes, that's right, that's my goal. And the other question I've got, and again, I might be completely out of whack, but coming to the visitor accommodation and your suggestion of removing one of the rules, which is visitor accommodation, this is rule 21.5.34, visitor accommodation associated with ski activities, etc., not located below 1,100 metre.
Yes, so that was a standard that follows the conversation that we had in the earlier hearing. So that construction, if you like, that set of rules was the product of some discussion that evolved across the course of the hearings. And as I tried to explain earlier, that was the unintended consequence of having a submission which sought to provide for visitor accommodation within the area subzone, and the additional relief to extend the subzone, and recognising that could then result in the extension of visitor accommodation activity down to the third floor, that wasn't intended, and that was proposed as a tool to address that. Yeah, and I thought, you know, I realised that that could still be, it's up to the panel to decide, it may still be necessary or appropriate, but it would be less so in terms of the SOHO ban, obviously, given its altitude.
I suppose that's a question, because I think I can see how it works for your client then, but I think we do that Cadrona station, I like your name wrong, comes down much lower than that.
Yeah.
And therefore, by removing that rule, I don't know whether it's appropriate or not, because it's in part of the hearing, whether coming down below the 1100 metres will be appropriate or not, but effectively removing this rule enables a wider range, a wider locational outcome for certainly that subject.
Yes, it would.
That's for your client, but maybe not for others.
Yeah, and that's, I think it's a fair point that that may be appropriate in all of what other land areas that I enter, but I haven't focused particularly on land. It's about the extent to which it goes into land. The existing skewed subzone goes down below the 100 square metres, but I think it does. And it's more out to the area on the northern side on that eastern face above the Nakadrona station land, yes.
That's my big, I think it just goes to that whole broader issue that you were raising before about each stream talking to each other. Thank you, those are the questions I've got.
Just in terms of the of road access, in your understanding of the plan, what consents would be required at present to put road access in?
Under the operating plan, the consents that would be required to establish conceptually, and so this would be in the event that you've got a ski area, say, such as Soho, that was disconnected from its running, then to establish the connection to the road, I think you would be establishing a ski area to the outside the ski area sometime. So that would be part of the activity, I think.
Well, let's look at the definition of ski area and subsistence.
I don't have the opera plan definitions, sorry.
I'm not really concerned about this operative.
As I said, respect of the.
I'm more interested in how you view that would be required in the proposed. I said plan because the earthworks chapter isn't in the plan yet, obviously. But what I'm getting at, is it an earthworks question or is it an activity question?
I think both. I think we're looking at the ski area activity itself, so the activity which is generating the need for the traffic and the adequacy of the road and its formation would be derived from the activity and its expected traffic generation. So I would view the establishment of the access as being a ski area activity outside the ski area subzone. And the physical effects of the construction of a road is beyond the existing or any existing road corridor that resulted in earthworks above the thresholds within the current operative plan rules, which trigger a requirement for consent, I think, as a restricted discretionary activity. I think it's the status for volumes and areas.
So there may be conceivably that sort of standard we could expect. I've got no idea what is in the council's mind for the proposed plan, but I can't imagine, given how recently it was made operative, that it's going to vary particularly. So we'd be saying restricted discretionary activity for
earthworks.
Yes. And then if it was a ski area activity, but I have to think about that, and council might like to consider that in its reply, that would be whatever status that ended up as.
Yeah, well, so...
So you're seeking it to be discretionary?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And the third component would be the indigenous vegetation clearance.
Yes.
Now that may not apply outside of the ski area sometime, given the evidence that we've had before about the predominance of exotic vegetation, but like, depends entirely where it goes.
So yes, it depends on what needs, what you've got. And the ecologists say that apart from that, it's more here on Blackland Creek. There is nothing below 1100.
Well, it's not nothing, that's more would you trim the rule, and yes, that's relating to the area, the area threshold of, I think, what that is, sort of like that. So,
and that would be RB2.
That's discretionary, fully discretionary. Yeah. So then you go up into the ski area sometime itself, and that's when you would have more like.
Oh, yes, I remember.
But the alpine, I think it's the. And then, of course, you've got any standards that might relate to the actual design of the vehicle crossing. Now, we don't have as yet a transportation checker, so we don't have. I can't advise what that could be.
But that is. Those things tend to be restricted, especially to the vehicle crossings.
Tend to be.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, they're not. The council doesn't usually make them non compliant.
No, they don't. And,
most presentation thing was a.
Yeah.
You do the diagram, you satisfy that.
So the main, I think the main triggers would be the ski area activity outside the ski area subzone, the earthquakes, and the vegetation clearance. And that's in the absence of specific buildings or structures.
In paragraph 15, we were talking about the base station, the two terminal stations requiring separate DC. Presumably that would apply to any lift station too, if there were to be lift stations.
Yes, yes it would. Yes. If that was below the ski area sometime.
Well, it was within, yes, it was still, but it was still within it would just be a building within the ski area subzone.
If it was within the subzone, it would be a building and control activity.
Yeah.
And below, it would be.
The same as the base station.
Correct.
Yeah.
Which would either be non compliant or discretionary, depending on where we land. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's another matter which is not directly related your client's position, but has risen, and I'd like your understanding as a planner and looking at the rules as the council reply version. Is it your understanding of those rules that within the ski area subzones, the passenger lift systems are a controlled activity?
Yes.
Yep. Good. There is an inconsistency that ski area activities identified as permitted as well. And so I just wanted to clarify, I'm just trying to get that it is generally, it's been accepted by other people who've made evidence, have given evidence that it is controlled. And I think it's one of those errors in the way the terminology has been put in that we should correct.
Okay. Just my first reaction would be that. So it's a passenger lift system that fits within that definition, and it is located within this area subzone. That would be quite clearly part. So that's a case of the specific overriding the general. I would have thought that was quite clearly a control activity. And on that point, I think I can make an observation if I could, and this goes to Commissioner Hill's question to Ms. Pfluger about the explanation to the possible explanation for the differences between the landscape witnesses and why they reached different conclusions. Now, accepting what Ms. Pfluger said before, one of the elements that I thought was a key difference from a planning perspective that I read into the differences between the evidence was that Dr. Reed didn't appear to understand the effect of development of ski activity infrastructure within the ski area subzone on the Soho Headland, where that came down, how far that came down the that slope on the Blackness Creek Band. And she talked in her initial statement of evidence, I think, about the effect on that, on those high slopes of being quite prominent and visible.
And I think Ms. Fleger had a very helpful diagram,
which was a figure that provided just a sort of three-dimensional overlay of where the existing ski system went. And it shows how far that comes down from the existing zone, how far that comes down the slope. So if you need a graphic representation of how that actually looks on the ground, that plan is a really good plan to refer to. Now, that only answers part of the question, I realise, and I just wanted to draw that to your attention.
Can I ask that? Sorry, you, in that graph, the red line, is that the 1100 metre line?
Yeah, that's the 1100 metre line. And the existing ski area subzone is the larger of the two polygons, and the smaller one, which extends down to below, is the extension, as originally sought. Yeah.
So, Ms. Scott drew to my attention that we might make some corrections to Mr. Ferguson's appendix too, just in terms of how tracking is shown, not just the words.
It's a bit confusing at the moment.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing at the moment.
Council's
version. Yeah, so I think, or I propose, and you tell me if this is the most helpful, well on Friday, we'll submit a corrected version of Mr. Ferguson's appendix too, so that Council's right of reply version of the words is clean.
It's black and white.
Yeah, black and white. We'll find some clear way.
Red strike out, red underlined.
Yeah.
That way, because there's still the proposed, the notified version.
Yeah. So we've sort of got three stages of tracking to show. So we'll have another attempt at that and submit that on Friday. So the words won't change, just the colours and lines and so on.
Ms. Scott, yeah.
Okay. Sir, in terms of timing, would that be able to be provided by the closing of the hearing? We just have the applicant hearing starting on Monday, so Thursday and Friday is our time allocated to reply, essentially.
Oh.
So would that be possible?
Mr. Ferguson seems to think it is.
Wouldn't Matt be available by then, too?
Sorry? Probably. We can get it coming back done tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow, yeah.
Yep, yeah. Yep.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, Ms. Scott, can we say the end of the day tomorrow? Because we'll be finished before lunchtime, but it's the end of the day tomorrow.
Thank you,
I
appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay. And we actually have a spot for you tomorrow morning, right? We're going to need that.
Well, we won't need that now. No, that's right. But I can tell you that Mr. Goldsmith won't be able to start early because he's intermittent for a few minutes.
No, that's okay. We will just start later because we've got Mr. Farrell before this
point. Oh, right. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. And we will do the tomorrow morning.